It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright.
Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around, turn me around, turn me around.
This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
Virginia still allows you to write out a will in longhand, and it can be effective. I guess most attorneys try and discourage that, primarily because you don't think ahead about all the things that are required. We just talked about what's required in a will, two witnesses and a notary. And the affidavit attached to the will is really important because that makes it a self-proved will, and you're not going to have that if you just write out your wishes in longhand. So most attorneys suggest strongly that you go ahead and have prepared by an attorney who does write wills to make sure it will go through the court properly and there won't be any problems.
Fletcher Cook, Director of Legal Advocacy at Crater Area Agency on Aging in Petersburg, talks about wills, whether you need one, and what happens if you die without one. And during this week's News You Can Use, you'll get a sneak peek at the health benefits exchanges that will be operating at this time next year to provide health insurance for uninsured people in 2014. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 190, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. Imagine if buying health insurance was kind of like reserving a hotel room. You log on to a website and answer questions about your age, the number of people in your family, your address. You answer more questions about your income, whether you want to keep your doctor, your preferred deductible amount, and whether you want to pay a percentage of your health cost out of pocket for some more expensive services. Then, voila! A list of insurers and plans appears, with standardized descriptions of prices and benefits. All you have to do is choose one and sign up. That's how a health benefits exchange works. Under the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, starting this time next year, people with low to moderate incomes will be able to purchase individual plans this way for coverage that begins in 2014. Exchanges also are being set up for small businesses. It's not just about online shopping. The exchange for individual plans allows people who meet income guidelines and don't have access to other affordable coverage to pay lower premiums and out-of-pocket costs through tax credits and other government assistance. It also requires plans to make public disclosures that include finances, denied claims, and enrollee rights, among other things. In addition, it rates each plan based on quality and price. Finally, it operates a toll-free phone assistance hotline and pays for a program to educate the public about the exchange. The Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act calls for exchanges in every state. Though anyone can use them to shop for individual plans, they're geared toward uninsured people who earn too much to be eligible for Medicaid but struggle to pay for coverage. The exchanges also provide a way for smaller employers to get insurance for their workers. By 2019, about 24 million people will buy individual plans through an exchange, along with another 5 million employed by small businesses. In Virginia, about 283,000 individuals and 232,000 small business employees could participate in the exchanges in 2014. States can elect to build their own exchanges, enter into a state-federal partnership exchange, or default to one run by the federal government. They may transition to a different model after the exchanges start operating in 2014. Virginia missed the November 16 deadline to submit a blueprint for their exchange, but the Department of Health and Human Services extended the deadline to allow Virginia and other states more time to submit plans to create their own exchanges rather than default to the federal one. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegebright. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's case that changed the Commonwealth is NCNB Financial Services versus Shoemate. In October and November 1982, Nations Bank of North Carolina garnished a bank account at Premier Bank of Withville, belonging to Joseph Shoemate. Funds in the account included a pension and Social Security disability benefits. The pension was not exempt from garnishment, and the Social Security benefits were exempt, but the entire account was garnished. Shoemate filed a motion to quash the garnishment in the United States District Court, which held that Social Security benefits are protected even if they are commingled in a savings or checking account with funds from other sources. The court went on to say that if a recipient of Social Security benefits commingles the benefits with other funds, he is entitled to protection as to those funds that are reasonably traceable to Social Security income. This has been the law ever since. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault, and NCNB Financial Services versus Shoemate is this week's case that changed the Commonwealth.
Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. We're here at the Crater District Area Agency on Aging in Petersburg, Virginia, and we are speaking with Fletcher Cook, attorney at law, director of legal services and public policy at the Crater District Area Agency on Aging, and we will be talking today about wills and powers of attorney. Welcome to the show, Fletcher.
Well, thank you very much, Marty. I appreciate your coming in to talk about these things.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. And before we start talking about wills and powers of attorney, you indicated that the Crater District Area Agency on Aging is unique in the state of Virginia as compared to other area agencies on aging. How are you unique?
Well, Marty, there's 25 area agencies on aging throughout the Commonwealth of Virginia, each one having their own region. Our region is actually from Colonial Heights, Petersburg, and Hopewell south to the North Carolina line. One of the things that sets us apart, and it's really a credit to Director David Sadowski Sr., he felt very strongly that providing legal services to seniors was a very important thing to do. So I'm the third lawyer in a row where he's hired, and basically I work full-time for the agency providing legal services directly to seniors. And I'm the only one in who does that and throughout the entire Commonwealth. So we're kind of a unique agency, and we try and provide basic services, which are essentially wills, powers of attorney, advanced medical directives, and I do a lot of guardianship work too.
So let's start with wills, and would you tell our listeners just basically what is a will?
Well, a will is a document where you indicate who you want to leave your stuff to when you pass away, to put it as simply as possible. Commonwealth of Virginia doesn't require that you have a will or that a will be written for you. If you don't have a will when you pass away, Virginia Code dictates who inherits your stuff.
And would you tell us briefly what happens if you die without a will? It's called dying intestate. Who does get your stuff?
Well, there's a hierarchy of who's in line to inherit your stuff. First in line normally is your spouse. If you don't have a spouse when you pass away, then it would go to your children. If you don't have any children when you pass away, then it would go to your parents. And if the parents have already passed away, then it goes to your brothers and sisters.
And what happens if you die and you have a surviving spouse and children? Who would inherit your belongings?
If you have children from a prior marriage, under Virginia law, the spouse you're married to when you pass away would inherit one-third of your estate, and your children from a prior marriage would inherit two-thirds of your estate. For example, right now I have a client who's in a nursing home, and he has five children from a prior marriage. He's married to his second wife, and he wants her to inherit everything. So I told him, I recommended him strongly that if he did a will, he could arrange that she would inherit, his present wife would inherit anything. But if he doesn't do a will and he passes away intestate, then his present wife would get a third of his estate, and the children from the prior marriage will share in two-thirds of his estate, which he doesn't want to have happen.
So to make sure that doesn't happen, he needs to do a will. Now, you mentioned that he is in a nursing home, and I gather the law is that you have to be, quote, of sound mind to do a will. What does of sound mind mean?
Well, it means you have to understand what it is you're signing when you sign either a will or a power of attorney. Criteria for a sound mind to sign a will is less than to sign a contract such as a power of attorney. But in both instances, you need to understand, for example, for a will, you need to understand who the natural objects of your bounty are, and you need to know what you want to leave and to whom you want to leave it.
And what other information needs to be in a will? I gather you have to know your belongings, you have to know who you give it to, and what about who takes care of all of this? Do you have to name that?
Typically in a will, you always name an executor. The executor is the person who, when you pass away, will take the original of the will and the death certificate to the clerk of the circuit court where you passed away and qualified to be the executor. And the executor's duty, very briefly, or essentially, is to notify the creditors, pay off any creditors you might have when you pass away from what's in your estate, and then distribute what's left according to the terms of the will. The executor doesn't have a lot of discretion to do whatever he wants to. He's supposed to essentially follow what the will requires.
And what should be put in the will to guard against the possibility of the person you name as the executor just being unable or unwilling to do that?
The main thing is you want to make sure that you're naming an executor who's going to comply with your wishes, essentially. If the executor doesn't act appropriately, then the heirs can actually go to court to see, have the executor removed and have someone else replace as an executor, but you'd have to know what the executor is doing to be able to do that. It gets kind of messy sometimes.
Well, do you recommend that people name not only an executor, but an alternate executor in case the originally named executor is just unable or unwilling to take charge?
Yeah, very often we'll name an executor and then a substitute or a backup executor if for some reason the original person you name is not able to perform the duties of an executor. For example, maybe they passed away, or perhaps they are not able to post a necessary bond, or for whatever reason, probably about 75% of my wills will name at least a backup executor. Sometimes you can name co-executors. I've had clients request that, and that's not too infrequent. The only drawback to co-executor is both co-executors have to sign all the documents. That can sometimes be a problem if they don't live in the same area, or I have one case where co-executors and one of them got very sick and was ended up in a nursing home, and they had to delay the probate process until that particular co-executor recovered and he could sign everything.
And what if the two co-executors just can't agree? What do you do then? Is that maybe a reason to not do a co-executorship?
If you have two people who are not able to get along with each other, that's probably a good reason not to have co-executors, as a matter of fact.
Now, could you lead us through the mechanics of preparing and signing a will? Do there have to be witnesses? Does it have to be notarized? What's the procedure for making sure that it is valid and will be recognized by the courts?
In Virginia, when you sign a will, there has to be two witnesses present, two disinterested witnesses, and also a notary present. And in Virginia, one reason to go to an attorney, you have the will prepared instead of using these will-in-the-box things you get from Staples and other places, is to make sure that in addition to the will, you have an affidavit attached to the will to make it a self-proved will, which means that you take it to when the person passes away, the named executor takes the original of the will and the death certificate to court. If it's a self-proved will, normally there's not any problems. The clerk of the circuit court will accept it and file it, and you go from there.
And is it possible in Virginia for someone to handwrite a will? And if so, what are the pitfalls of doing that?
Virginia still allows you to write out a will in longhand, and it can be effective. I guess most attorneys try and discourage that, primarily because you don't think ahead about all the things that are required. We just talked about what's required in a will, two witnesses and a notary. And the affidavit attached to the will is really important because that makes it a self-proved will, and you're not going to have that if you just write out your wishes in longhand. So most attorneys suggest strongly that you go ahead and have prepared by an attorney who does write wills to make sure it will go through the court properly and there won't be any problems.
Which, of course, makes your services as the Director of Legal Services at Crater District Area Agency on Aging so valuable. Could we now talk about powers of attorney, which is the other thing that we wanted to discuss today, the other thing that you do a lot of work on? Tell our listening audience, what is a power of attorney?
You know, I probably do more powers of attorney than anything else. And oftentimes it's a situation where, let's say, a mother has had a stroke, she's in the hospital, and for some reason all of her money is in the bank account, she's the only one on the bank account. I'll get a call from one of the children saying, we can't access mom's money to pay her bills that are coming due if she's going to be in there for a protracted period of time. So I get a lot of times I end up going to either hospitals, nursing homes to prepare the power of attorney ahead of time for them to sign it in the presence of a notary, which you have to do.
But what's the power of attorney going to do for the person who signs one and the person who receives it?
Essentially, a power of attorney is a document where you authorize someone to be your agent to do things that are set forth in the document itself. The ones I prepare are very broad and have no time limit on them because it's important if you're dealing with seniors not to have a power of attorney that for a certain period or duration, you want it to be an unlimited time period. It authorizes, the ones I prepare authorize the agent to take it to the bank where the parents' account is, put their name on the account so they can access the account to pay bills that come due using the parents' funds. Also, broad enough that circumstances require the agent can actually put the house up for sale to sell the house. They can sign contracts. They can sign deeds. They can do pretty much everything the principal, who's the person who signs a power of attorney, can do. Usually it's necessary so that they're able to essentially take care of the senior who's in the hospital or the nursing home.
Now, does the person who gets the power of attorney, the agent, do they become in any way personally responsible for the bills, debts, obligations of the principal, the person who signs the power of attorney and gives it to the agent?
No. The agent's authorized to use the principal's funds to pay the principal's bills. They're not assuming personal liability for the bills of the principal.
So when they're acting as power of attorney and signing something, how should they be signing it?
Well, they can sign it a couple of different ways. One is Joe Smith, power of attorney for, and name the principal, or sign the principal's name by Joe Smith, power of attorney or agent. The reason that mine is so broad, it's really important to be able to cover whatever might come up. You never know what's going to come up, especially when you're dealing with seniors who might have all kinds of different problems arise.
Now, when we talked about wills, you recommended definitely going to an attorney and not using one of these wills in a box. Mm-hmm. What about a power of attorney? Do you also recommend that an attorney in Virginia prepare it, or could you possibly use a power of attorney in a box?
I would recommend getting an attorney to prepare it. People have come to me who have gotten one of these forms from Staples or from some other source, maybe on the internet probably, and they filled it in, but they haven't filled it in correctly. In Virginia, the power of attorney just has, when a person signs a power of attorney, you just have a notary present, and the notary signs it. But sometimes with these forms, they fill it in such a way that they don't really complete it correctly or properly, and it's not going to be effective.
And then lastly, you mentioned that to sign a will, you have to be of sound mind, and that you said that the test for signing a power of attorney was also to be of sound mind, but it was a bit of a stricter test. Could you tell us what you mean by that?
Well, a power of attorney is a contract, basically, where the principal is naming someone to be his agent. And the criteria for entering into a contract is, I believe in Virginia, a higher level than just for doing a will. If you're signing a will, you just have to know the natural objects of your bounty and have an idea about what it is you have and who you want to leave things to. But for a contract, you have to understand what it is exactly that you're doing and what powers you're conferring upon your agent to make sure that you know you're authorizing this individual to act on your behalf. The main thing about doing a power of attorney is you have to have absolute confidence and trust in the person you're naming as your agent, because so often there have been a number of instances where agents have not acted properly. There was one case years ago before I got here where this lady made her nephew her agent under a power of attorney, and the agent decided, well, the best thing for her really was for him to take her money and buy himself a pickup truck. Well, the family got together and they undid that, but too often it's very difficult to undo something once the money's been taken and been used for purposes it wasn't intended to use for. An agent under a power of attorney has a fiduciary duty to act in the best interest of the principal, and there are actions that can be taken if the person doesn't, including taking him to court and suing him. But a lot of times, the money's already been spent when somebody gets around to trying to undo a power of attorney and recover or take action against the agent for improperly using the funds of the principal.
And this has probably happened to you, because it certainly happened to Legal Aid, where someone comes and say, I want to get a power of attorney over my mom or dad, and it turns out they're just not really mentally competent. What do you do in that situation?
You know, I've got a standing rule that if anybody, any child comes to me and asks me to prefer a power of attorney for mom or dad, first I ask them whether if they've been diagnosed with any dementia or Alzheimer's. And if they have, I tell them I can't do anything until I get something in writing from their physician indicating whether in the physician's opinion that individual would understand what it is they're signing, would understand what a power of attorney is. I'm not a doctor myself, so I really want something in writing from the principal's doctor to give me some comfort that they understand what it is they're signing. Sometimes I'll talk to people, and if it doesn't appear like they're quite completely understanding what it is they're signing, then I will ask, even if they haven't been diagnosed with dementia or Alzheimer's, for something in writing from the physician indicating whether, in the physician's opinion, they would understand what they're signing. And doctors around here have been pretty good about doing that. Sometimes they don't like it, but they understand the process, and they'll go ahead and let me know whether they believe that my client comprehends what they're doing when they sign a power of attorney.
Well, thank you very much. We have been talking with Fletcher Cook. He is the Director of Legal Services and Public Policy at the Crater District Area Agency on Aging, and we have been talking about wills and powers of attorney. Thank you so much for being on the show, Fletcher.
Thank you, Marty. It was fun.
You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's Strange But True Law is from Title 67, which deals with Virginia's energy plan. Under Code of Virginia Section 67-1301, the Department of Mines, Minerals, and Energy must provide an option for people to make voluntary contributions to the Voluntary Solar Resource Development Fund in a manner that allows customers to choose to contribute $1, $5, $10, or some other amount. And electric utilities must provide a link on their internet site to the relevant section of the department's website where the donation to the fund may be made. Although the donation site is up and running on the department website, no such link can be found at Dominion's Powers website. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King, and that's this week's Strange But True Law.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio show ever broadcast is available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral for, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We all buy products every day, but what if you purchased is seriously and dangerously defective? Join us next week when private attorney Ted Allen from the law firm of Allen & Allen explains the law of product liability in a rebroadcast of a show originally heard on June 15, 2011. That's law for the rest of us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Whitaker.